Hello, and welcome to Tolerable Risk, the podcast for NGO, nonprofit, and charity professionals who manage risk. I'm your host, Sabrina Siegel.
My guest today is Rupert Evel. Rupert is the founder of Ethics Insight, providing risk assessment, program implementation, and investigative support. He has operated in over 50 countries in a 22-year career, spanning investigations, ethics and compliance, intelligence gathering, due diligence, and crisis response. Rupert has augmented this experience with postgraduate studies in behavioral analysis and investigative interviewing. He is a certified fraud examiner and the author of Bootstrapping Ethics, Integrity Risk Management for Real-World Application. Rupert, thank you so much for coming on Tolerable Risk today. I'm really looking forward to our conversation. Your background is so interesting. All of the places that you've lived, the types of things that you've done. I'm really looking forward to have you share your experiences with the folks listening today, because I think your international point of view is going to be really helpful for folks listening. We're going to be talking about ethics and risk in the third sector. So Rupert, thank you so much. Welcome to Tolerable Risk.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm looking forward to it.
So for people who aren't familiar with you or your background or the things that you've done, can you just tell us a little bit more about the work that you do and some of the experiences that you've had?
Yeah, sure. I think my path is quite accidental, but it's worked out okay in the end. So when I was leaving university, I saw a lot of people going into kind of traditional careers and they didn't appeal. And then I saw an advert for counterterrorism political risk analyst. And I thought, okay, that's kind of interesting. So that was where I started. And I think what was helpful about that is in that discipline, there's not much sort of room for unusable methodology, too much process, waffle, et cetera. It's pretty to the point. And the kind of crisis management thinking and threat assessment approach was quite helpful. And I liked it. And in about 2006, after I'd been doing that work for, I guess, 3-4 years, I got an opportunity to take a role in investigations. And I was covering EMEA at the time. This is back in London. And the sort of 2006 to 2008 run-up were really interesting because it's where I started to first sort of see how business had a role to play in the problems that society faces. So I've been looking at terrorism, political violence, civil unrest, all that kind of stuff. And then now I was starting to see where business came into it as well. And that was, you know, both good and bad, pretty sobering. I decided quite early in that process that maybe there's certain elements of the financial sector that are going to be very hard to influence change. And in 2010, I applied for an opportunity to move to Asia to help set up an investigations practice there. But particularly, my job was to build up a network across Southeast Asia of assets, essentially people who could provide information and sort of sources and data on some of the sort of risk issues, political, non-governmental, private sector, all of it in and around sort of Southeast Asia. And I was still doing a lot of investigations, crisis response, but around about 2011-12, I started to feel that I was hitting a bit of a wall with my investigative skills. So I went back to do further studies, postgrad studies in behavioral analysis and investigative interviewing. And my intention was obviously to be better at investigations, but the byproduct was actually, it gave me more of a kind of an empathy for the people on the end of corruption, human rights issues, and all of the rest of it. And I realized that we could keep responding in this sort of whack-a-mole fashion to these issues, or maybe we should start sort of better calibrating risk and addressing it and understanding it and building cultures and frameworks to manage it. And that, fortunately, that was the mood of many organizations at the time. I think they were sort of starting to get a bit fed up with this reactive approach to risk. And in 2019, I decided to go out on my own, start my own business. And I mean, like anyone starting your own business, the plan you have versus what you end up doing are two very different things. But I guess what I found in that process was that some of the folks that are most underserved in terms of support around risk, and when I talk about risk, I'm particularly talking about integrity risks, so corruption, human rights, money laundering, sanctions, all those type of things. There's a huge sort of portion that are somewhat underserved. So if you're a massive like Fortune 500, you can go and buy in a big sort of in-house team or afford sort of ritzy glitzy consultants. But then the SMEs, third sector, parts of government, then they're not really so well served. And so that's where I spend most of my time now, trying to help those folks with maybe simplified approach to risk than you know, that's actually right sized to them rather than this kind of cookie cutter approach I'm seeing increasingly with the kind of the big programs that all these big organizations have, but don't actually necessarily seem to be reducing risk.
What an interesting, fascinating history and kind of background that you've had. So what countries have you worked in?
Well, I'm not going to list them all because it'd be very boring, but I think at last count, I worked out, I'd operated in about 50 countries, just a bit over. Obviously, pretty much everywhere in Asia. I was there for 12 and a half years, and my remit from Southeast Asia expanded after 5 years to cover broader Asia. When I was in EMEA, I was working across that region at different times, different places. So I remember, like, in the run-up to that, the credit crunch, there was a huge amount of former Soviet Union countries that where there was an interface with London, and then that expanded to include Middle East and North Africa. And at the moment, Sub-Saharan Africa is with one of the main areas where I'm working. So I had done the odd bits and pieces in Central and Southern America, but it's predominantly Asia and EMEA.
It's such a neat opportunity to be able to bounce around and experience all of these different countries and all these different cultures. And when you overlay that with what you're talking about, or what we're going to be talking about today, this sort of concept of integrity risk, it really is a main thematic element, is sort of the different cultural approaches to this. So it's great that you have that ability to draw from the different places that you've worked. And part of the reason why I wanted to invite you on the podcast today was because I had heard you talking about your experience, particularly around considering the different cultural elements when it comes to integrity risk. And I thought that it would really be helpful and interesting for the listeners of Tolerable Risk, because lots of charities and nonprofits work in international development and humanitarian response, and cultural sensitivities and working in cross-cultural environments is a real key to the third sector. So really happy that you're here. So let's get started then on the topic. We're going to be talking today about integrity risk, or ethics. Can you just define the term so that we're all making sure we're working from the same point of view as we listen today?
Wow, but now you've really put me on the spot. Like, when I started out, it was most people just worried by anti-corruption, bit of sort of know your customer, money laundering, all that kind of stuff. Now it's almost expanding on a daily basis to include areas that traditionally might have been sustainability. So the European Union due diligence directive was a good example, where we're now expanding into both environmental and human rights sustainability. But the area I've traditionally worked in would be corruption, fraud, bit of money laundering, a lot of talk about human rights, not as much actual action on it. But that said, I've found, like, different countries have different approaches. So your cultural thing stuff is really interesting, because, for example, when I was working with Japanese organizations, they would expand those integrity risks to also include things that might sit in many organizations with human resources, like discrimination, harassment, even like drunk driving, because they saw them as indicators of overall kind of cultural health. And if you have those type of problems, you're often going to have the other ones, like fraud and corruption. So where I spend the majority of my time, I guess, would be corruption, human rights, where that sort of interacts, that nexus between government, third sector, business on those issues. But I have touched on the others, and I'm increasingly working with experts in the S and the E side of ESG, the environmental sort of impact and social impact, on studies done by particularly Nordic organizations that are looking at their impact in the emerging markets that they're operating in, and they're starting to bring the strands together. So that's been really fascinating.
So I guess, aside from the fluid nature of the definition of the integrity or ethics sector right now, when you're working with organizations, or you're working with people, or you're just maybe trying to explain to them what it is you do, what do people get wrong? What do they misunderstand about this topic?
Yeah, if you start saying you work in risk, a lot of people might assume that stuff like financial risk and or enterprise risk, that type of stuff. When you say ethics, they think of some awful training program that they had to sit through, where they just kind of, you know, clicked through and got patronized about how they're meant to behave. So you're right, it can be a difficult thing to explain to people. But I think that's why I'm like you, I see a lot of what you write about, and I prefer just talking about it in plain terms. Where I work is where your good intentions meet operational reality. We can term that whatever you want, but you're going to face pressures to compromise your values in a lot of places. So that's where we work. And I think one of the things that I know you're very passionate about, as am I, in our world, we can get caught up with terminology that we understand. And something like ethics can be very loaded. So I think often when I'm talking to people, you're obviously trying to be on receipt more than broadcast. So you might just explain to them, being in normal human terms, like, so where do you face pressures or conflict or disagreement on your intentions and your values and your standards with the places you're operating in. And then we just take it from there rather than talking about some morality and ethics right from the off.
Well, that's really interesting. I like what you just said there, where good intentions meet operational reality. You can sit back and think about that one and roll that one over in your mind for a while and apply that to a lot of different challenges that risk and integrity and compliance folks might face. So I like how you frame that. Can you talk a little bit about how your work in integrity and ethics and risk overlaps with social impact? Because social impact is something that we in the third sector have been talking about for a while now. You know, whether it's social impact, whether it's programmatic impact, whether it's whatever word you want to put in front of the word impact. Impact has been something that's been around now for a decade at least. So when we're thinking about risk and ethics and integrity, and we're thinking about impact, how do you frame those two together?
I'm still working that one out. I think one of the things I'm starting to realize is the kind of law of unintended consequences, but there's also the rebound effect. There's all these theories out there that show that sometimes our intention can sometimes have unintended consequences. So to give like maybe a slightly weird example, but it's one that's fresh in my mind, is the government here in the UK was concerned that they've got fairly aggressive sort of renewables in it and targets. And so they set this goal that all new build houses have to have like high levels of insulation so that in theory they reduce energy usage. But what's actually happened is energy usage has gone up as people now walk around in sort of shorts and t-shirts all year round. So sometimes our impact can be completely the opposite to which we intended. So I think in terms of where the two worlds meet, it's not very complicated. And Danielle, that this lady who's so good on social impact, one of the things that she always reminds me, just talk to people, because I think sometimes there's a danger that we are thinking in theoretical or terms, or we're distance in our thinking from where the impacts will happen. And we're like, well, this would be good, or this looks good. And then we don't actually bother speaking to the people who'd be affected by it. So I saw this particularly, it's most acute where you're going into somewhere with very little in place. So I remember like 2011 and 12 when Myanmar started opening up after the general eased the control on the reins slightly, albeit obviously that's now gone all back. But when the country was opening up, there were a lot of these organizations in aid, government, third sector, big MNCs, all the rest of them. And they all knew that they had to be aware of impact, and they'd call that different things, like, you know, be called CSR or social impact. And what I found interesting is when you're speaking to the folks that have been operating there for a long time, so other Asian nations. So I remember speaking to somebody who worked for a Malaysian governmental organization, and they were baffled by this sort of frenzy and just said, why is nobody speaking to these disparate local communities? So I think where impact overlaps with what I do is that what I do, unfortunately, is also guilty of not speaking to people enough. And so where we both succeed is when we actually go and speak to people and understand how decisions that might be made from an integrity perspective or from another perspective will have impacts. And then we can start to prioritize and also look at the trade-offs, because unfortunately it's difficult to get everything right immediately. You have to look at short, medium term, or what's most important, what are the trade-offs, what's that going to look like, and then make sure that everyone's involved in those decisions.
Yeah, absolutely. Having that patience element is so key when you're trying to address things like integrity and culture. I mean, there are some things where you want to say, well, I'm not going to have patience with bullying. I'm not going to have patience with sexual harassment. But maybe some other subtle elements about culture and integrity are different. One of the things that you and I had a conversation earlier, we were talking about facilitation payments, right? Mm-hmm. And that concept of corruption and thinking about whether you call it a bribe, whether it's graft, whether it's a facilitation payment or a sitting fee, that's something that can be very ingrained in a culture of just this is the cost of doing business. So can you talk a little bit about something like that, if we're talking about a cultural element that on an integrity point of view may not be welcome? How can organizations identify that? And then what do they do if they find something like that? How do they address it?
Identify, speak to their people. I think one of the things that I see some sort of centralized teams do is they devise what they think is like a best practice, a program, but they haven't actually spoke to their folks within the organization or the people who've got experience of that particular area. Because as you know, countries differ. A lot of the countries I worked in, particularly in Asia, are huge. And so this idea that they operate homogeneity across the whole sort of country is crazy. So you speak to people who've got experience of that particular area to understand what's likely to happen. So again, that's where the good intentions meet the reality. And then in terms of what to do about it, well, you and I in our previous conversation talked about the fraud triangle, which has opportunity, pressure, and rationalization on each of the three sides. Most organizations will naturally gravitate towards opportunity. You know, where is the opportunity for wrongdoing to happen? Where can we stick in control? And I understand that response, but all the data suggests that a control failure accounts for only about a third of these kind of integrity issues. And the majority of time, it's sort of human override or human inaction or action. And that's obviously driven by pressure and our own rationalization of it. So that until we start to understand the pressure, and that's where the threat assessments and my sort of background in the counterterrorism side is helpful, because you look at, well, what's the person's intention and what is their capacity? What's their capability? So if you're talking about an area very poorly served by road infrastructure where you've only got a certain number of routes in and they're controlled by the police who might, or the military who might have extortive tolls, or maybe they use like more funky ways to do it, like weighing stations or whatever the mechanism is, what's driving that behavior? Well, there tends to often be a pressure. They're channeling those facilitation payments, so small bribes up the channel to the senior officers. And what's the rationalization? Well, I'm standing out in all weathers and doing this sort of thankless task, and I get paid not enough for my family to live on, so I have to get these extra payments, almost like tips. And it sometimes you go into super gray areas, because sometimes these public officials are providing a sort of service to the organization, but they're not compensated for it. So I've seen this in many cases, like something as basic as having a police or military escort. If you're trying to take anything of value, whether that be aid or machinery, whatever it is, and they will be providing some sort of outrider escort. So they're putting their lives on the line potentially for you. There's no codified way of paying them. So until you understand these sort of messy areas, it's very difficult to work out what to do about it. But once you understand the pressure people are under, they become human. And then there's often a way that you can start to work together. But again, it's over time. It's not immediate, and it has to be prioritized. So you have to think, well, who of all these people we interact with sits on our critical path, who is essentially a major blocker? And that's the bit that I find interesting, because actually once you start to break it down to those components, it becomes surprisingly easy to start to find better ways to have dialogue and motivate people.
That's really fascinating. And I love how you're relating it back to that very traditional Cressy fraud triangle with the opportunity, pressure, and rationalization. And you're absolutely right. I think so many organizations focus on the opportunity because it's something that's within their control, right? I can put in an additional approval step, or I can put some software that will monitor this, or I can put in whatever it is that needs to be done. There, I pat myself on my back, you know, look what I've done. I'm going to control integrity issues now. And you're absolutely right. You've got the other two parts of that triangle, which are human-centered variables, right? Your pressure and your rationalization. And that's extremely complicated. People like to use the word messy. I mean, it's messy too, but it's complicated. Humans are complicated. And so I like what you're talking about, is that it's not just your internal controls, but it's unpacking why are these things happening in our operating environment. And I also really like how you're emphasizing, talk to your staff. Your staff know, they live in this environment. It's really when you start to peel back those layers, it can be overwhelming. It can certainly present to you a much larger systemic challenge. But like you were saying, it humanizes the people that are involved. And I think it might give organizations and program teams a better opportunity to come up with some different solutions around that.
Yeah, absolutely. You just got to start somewhere. The analogy makes sense to me. I mean, complicated is a better word, but I'm going to use messy. It's like walking into a messy room. You just got to start somewhere. But I think one of the problems that some organizations have is they're stuck in kind of reporting cycles or disclosures and all that kind of stuff. So they're almost incentivized to try and paint this ridiculous picture that we all know doesn't exist. So that's one of the reasons I like working with organizations that are outside of those sort of crazy listed reporting requirements, because they can actually be a bit more honest about where we're going to. And I remember one example in Indonesia where the organization was sort of coming to terms with facilitation payments. So we did a workshop and chatted to them, did some interviews, came back a couple of weeks later, and they presented this A4 printout, 4 pages, Arial 10 font, printed on both sides. And that was all the names of the people who they had to pay to just get stuff done. And that's not uncommon in some places. And initially, the head of sort of government relations actually physically banged his head on the table in despair. And the leader, who's a really good person, came in and said, "This is exactly the faces you gave me when we had to move to better health and safety standards 20, 30 years ago. We did that. we'll do this. It's going to take time, but this is the next thing we have to do, and it's the right thing. And I think once you have that shift in mentality, which is we're going to find a way, we're going to deal with it sensibly, we're going to break it down into its constituent parts, look at those that are most acute and start there, then it becomes manageable. And the other thing is you build up a momentum because other people are dealing with that same issue. Can you come together? Are there certain issues that maybe can be solved with that kind of leveraging your diplomatic or your G2G or whatever it is, relationships? So for example, I'm doing a project at the moment in Morocco. And if you look back when maybe 2019, Morocco was scoring horrendously on stuff like bribes to healthcare sector. And so now they're starting to look at certain forms of e-governance. They're starting to bring in some sort of changes to the market. And that's been brought about by a lot of people getting together and applying gentle pressure for improved standards. And the tax authority was also a real headache. And so some of the filings have now been moved to e-filing. So there are things that will improve. I think we can all bet on change. There's a lot of negative reporting out there about stagnation and corruption. And broadly, I would agree that there has been too little action, but I think that's almost the regulatory paradox. It's because the more people are forced to either push these problems down to sub-suppliers or smaller organizations or sweep them under the carpet or make these ridiculous zero tolerance pronouncements on their annual reports, it just means that we're not actually having a discussion about the issue and working through it together. So I think the SME and third sector, maybe I'm optimistic, but presents a better avenue to affect change because we're not bound by some of that same need to pretend things are the way that they aren't.
Yeah, I agree 100%. You had said in the beginning, you had talked about whack-a-mole. And I feel like the organizations that are just trying to run around and just hit down or solve one thing at a time and then say in their reports, yep, zero tolerance, which I hate that term anyway, is never going to address the problem. It really is systemic and in some places cultural, as in this is the culture of how we do business. And so it's just fascinating. In your experience working with these large organizations that have oodles of resources compared to small to medium-sized organizations, low to no resourced organizations, how are these things handled differently? Is it handled better by one or the other? I mean, everybody has to face an integrity challenge to do business, whether it's you are trying to move commercial goods from one place to another, or whether you're trying to move humanitarian goods from one place to another. So in your experience, can you talk a little bit about how integrity issues are handled differently or maybe addressed differently in the third sector versus private sector?
Yes. The beginning you mentioned, like the kind of the resources, my feeling, and it's probably not a very popular one with large amounts of people, is that the large organizations with major in-house teams, all they do is infantilize the population within their organization. And I've seen this with sort of organizations that have mega internal teams, and you have like senior managers asking them if they can take someone for a coffee. So that clearly means that people haven't actually understood the intention or what you're actually driving at in terms of the org integrity program. If they can't answer whether or not it's a good idea to be going out for a coffee with a potential client, then the program's failed in my view. And so I think that it's also a fear factor. Like once you have all of these folks in your organization who often are incentivized to act more in that kind of enforcer role, like a parent type role rather than an educator or counselor type role, then it does create this kind of them and us. And one of the things I used to do in my previous life when I was working with a lot more of these large organizations is at the beginning of any sort of workshop, I'd just allow catharsis. I'd say, you know, what would you call business integrity, compliance, whatever the internal team's called. And my favorite one came from the subsidiary of an American healthcare company in China. And they described compliance as a steamroller sent to crush the business. And I think that if that's your starting point for how the functions view each other, good luck. Whereas when you have less resources, it goes one of two ways. It's either that you don't know what you don't know, and then suddenly you get a nasty surprise or maybe a near miss, or you're setting out with some sort of purpose and some moral compass. And the analogy that makes sense to me is, I imagine, Will, to you as well, because you've also got young kids, is if you try and codify every behavior you want that child to follow, you're doomed to absolute failure. Neither of you are going to keep up, and there's going to be multiple sort of instances of inconsistency, violations, etc. So as a parent, you quickly have to work out that your job is to impart general values and a sort of a template on how to respond in situations. Does that mean that it goes perfectly? No, but I think it's an infinitely better approach than just trying to build more fence endlessly or just chucking more resources at the problem. So the third sector organizations I'm working with, or those I have in the past that are lighter on resources, people know why they're there and the mission is relatively clear, and anything that feels icky or isn't aligning with that is easier for people to flag. And as one of the best indicators of your ability to respond to ethical or integrity challenges is just asking people a question. I have identified someone I can talk to about ethical dilemmas. And in commercial organizations, you'll find that that hovers generally below 70%, except for some of the newer ones that are very purpose-driven, which are quite cool, and that may go much higher. Like there's one recently that's working in sort of renewable energy disruption that's near a sort of 80, 90%. But what you'll find in more mission-driven organizations is that people talk more. And I know it sounds very simple, it's potentially self-defeating for people like you and I who are meant to be providing services, to say that actually, if organizations just spoke more about this stuff internally and came together, they wouldn't need all of the fence.
I think that's great. I like the steamroller. How compliance is a steamroller set to crush your business, which absolutely I've heard similar things in the past. But also how you were talking about how you need to be more of a coach than a cop, so to speak, and listening and engaging and understanding where the challenge and the pressure and the pain points are with the organizations. I think organizations more these days with the ESG, or maybe it's the Gen Z or millennials or whoever, now that are coming in and demanding more accountability and they're more interested in some more of these social and environmental issues, I think it's being talked about more. So if someone's listening today from a small to medium-sized, low to no resource organization, and they're sitting here and they're listening to us talk and they're going, you know what? I know we have these challenges in my organization. I know that these are things that we have to face when we're implementing our programs. And we are just focusing on the opportunity, right? We're just doing the internal control stuff, but we need to get deeper. What would be some risks that the organization should be looking out for as they move deeper into this area, as they genuinely try and listen to their staff and address it? What are some of the speed bumps or the obstacles that they might face? And how can they move past them so they can continue down this path?
So there's both the tactical and then there's the strategic. So maybe I'll start with the tactical side and just give a brief example. So I have a friend who is building up an Australian startup that does very cool like micro-learning stuff, mobile enabled. They're targeting people who don't sit at laptops or aren't full-time employees of an organization and are often very poorly served with training. And that training could be anything. And so he called up and he goes, I need an anti-corruption framework. And I said, why? You're Australian domestic. You don't interact with government at all. It's subscription models. What's this? And he said, oh, the bank have told us we've got to have this. So there are going to be those organizations where, unfortunately, it's a requirement of whoever that you have certain things in place. And that is a sort of a box ticking checklist. And hopefully there's more people around, me included, who are able to help you with just ticking that box. So there's going to be that. Unfortunately, we have to be honest, there is going to be that performative stuff you need to do. But then the bigger question I had back to this friend was, you've hold hundreds of thousands of people's personal data. What about data and cyber risks? What are you doing about that? And so there doesn't need to be complicated. If you are providing, let's say, a healthcare program targeted at women in sub-Saharan Africa, then obviously security, human rights, education, those type of issues are going to be more acute, and you probably don't want to be wasting time worrying about money laundering. And so there is going to be that element. And I appreciate that I'm saying this from position of someone who's done this, and I have a huge empathy for people not knowing where to start, because I never knew where to start when I started this business with like the marketing and the admin and the finance. I didn't know what I didn't know. So there are folks out there like you who you can just have a quick call, and in half an hour you can get a much better clarity around, well, these are the types of sort of headline issues that you should probably be starting to think about and having some sort of approach to how you're going to manage it. But then going back to the strategic, whenever you're doing any planning, most organizations will do some sort of SWOT analysis, even if it's not called that. What I think we forget about risk is it lives on the other side of the opportunity, whether the opportunity is commercial or to create impact. Risk and opportunity coexist. So the biggest way to save money, I would argue, is to include risk thinking into that strategic planning. So even something as basic as we talked about facilitation payments, if you have to reach area X, because there's a famine or there's a dire need for aid, or that you have to service these particular rural communities, whatever it might be, that tactically you're going to be looking at well, how can we do that? How can we reach that? If you're also thinking and speaking to your people on the ground about this route, that route, does that present risk? Partnering with these folks, getting the supplies coming to this port versus that port, those type of decisions, you'll be making them operationally. All I'm saying is just have someone in the room or a few people that have that on the ground experience go, oh, actually, you know, that route is particularly unsafe, or that port, the customs officials are notorious for expecting bribes to process anything in a timely fashion. That knowledge will exist. And if you're building risk into that strategic planning, then you're not going to be doing that reacting, or you're going to have less exposure to the more extortive or unpleasant sides of things. So you're just going to be mitigating a lot of stuff at that planning stage. So that would be my advice for organizations. Get someone in the room at the planning stage. It's going to save you a whole world of time later on. And in terms of what risks are applicable, if it's not immediately obvious to you, there are people out there you can have a quick conversation with. They can point you in the right direction. And I would always start with whatever is most critical to your values. So if you're trying to affect positive things on the environmental side, then yeah, the environmental risk should be your number one thing. If you're trying to help people, then human rights should be your number one thing. So it doesn't need to be too complicated.
I really like your emphasis on risk in the strategic planning, because it's something that I find myself saying a lot, is that the risk people or team or thinking has to be at the table when the strategies are developed and the objectives are agreed upon. Because if your risk folks come in later and you throw a project proposal at them and say, okay, here, go do a risk analysis after the fact, it's not going to work. And so what you're describing is really the kind of risk approach that I like to take with organizations, with it's objective centered, right? What exactly is our objective? So like you were saying, if our objective is to bring goods into this port, right, then we ask ourselves, what are our opportunities and threats around that objective? And you're absolutely right. Again, having the right people at the table who have that experience, who can then say, okay, well, at this port, we need to expect 3 weeks of delays unless we pay a facilitation payment, right, an expediting fee, right? And the organization sits there and talks about it, and maybe even goes back to the funder and says, look, this is the reality on the ground. What do you want us to do about this? Having those really frank and clear conversations, acknowledging that you understand that this is in violation of whoever's code of conduct, and also then acknowledging that this is the way that business is done in this particular place, those two things can coexist, right? They are not mutually exclusive. I think the organizations that say they have a zero tolerance, they're all still happening, but they're just happening and everyone is burying their head in the sand, or they have this concept FOFO, fear of finding out, right? Maybe they're not going to ask these questions because they know it's happening. So what's better, right? Is it better to face it head on and have these very clear conversations and come up with a response, or know that it's happening but never document it? This is the reality for a lot of organizations that are functioning in environments like the ones you're describing.
I'm completely in agreement with you about zero tolerance. So when I was writing the book the year, 2 years ago, I think my headline was zero tolerance, zero clue. If I could remove two words from the whole integrity risk lexicon, it would be those two, because it is a huge deterrent for people to come forward. Because if you said that we are absolutely not tolerating something that is pervasive, then it makes it very hard for people to, particularly if you're talking about a lot of countries where there might be, as you said, different cultures, different attitudes to hierarchy, different ways of communicating, higher level context, maybe a repressive state where speaking out could have consequences. So you're then asking people to come forward about something you say you have zero tolerance. And it's just such a self-defeating thing, because firstly, a lot of people are going to be deterred. And those that do come forward are then going to be massively underwhelmed when you're not able to solve it. Because zero tolerance to me sets an incredibly high sort of bar that you're going to be able to solve these problems and make them go away. And you're just not. And your example as well with the ports, I remember working with an organization in Indonesia, and they were super practical, and they worked out that one port was really real headache. And if they could go to another port a couple of hours further north and then have like half a day more of trucking stuff, they wouldn't face those problems. So then it became, as you said, something you can then go to your funders and say, look, we're going to have longer lead times, it's going to cost more. And this is what my point about trade-offs. So the E impact is going to go up with the trucking, but we're going to be able to mitigate this sort of G issue, the governance issue, with the paying of the bribe. So then we can actually start to get somewhere. But yeah, if we have zero tolerance, I have so many issues with it, and it just seems very self-defeating and also deluded.
I love it. Zero tolerance, zero clue. I'm going to use that one in my next LinkedIn post. I'll credit you. I'll credit you, Rupert.
No worries.
If somebody is listening today and they're saying, okay, now I have a better sense of what these integrity and ethics issues are, how they relate to risk, I can think of a half a dozen off the top of my head that my organization is facing when we're trying to implement our programming. If the person listening today wants to make a business case to leadership and management for setting aside some resources, and it may not necessarily be money, it might just be time. It might be half of a staff member's time to really start to unpack this and come up with strategies and approaches and activities. And you were talking about tactical and strategic approaches to addressing integrity risk. What is the statement that they're going to put in their business case that's going to get them those resources? How do they craft this business case? Where's the value?
Well, when you find out, tell me. No, I think it is a tough one, and it very much depends on, again, it comes back to humans. Who are you making that case to? How are they receptive to information? So for some people, I've seen them put it in data terms where they might look at, I'm not a big fan of the, oh, you know, if we get caught, here are the fines, or you might face this, because it's a bit like sort of somebody trying to sell you some insurance policies. Nobody thinks it's going to happen to them. But there can be other ways that if you have the data, you might be able to quantify and say, for example, if we just keep with that box analogy, because it's simple, you're going to have to tolerate 3 weeks of delays unless we find some way of solving that, then you can maybe put that in numeric terms. Whereas if we were just able to try and resolve this one issue, 3 weeks over however many shipments on an annualized basis, how much more would we be able to achieve and how much more would we reduce costs? Therefore, is that worth half of someone's time? Maybe you have that data available. Unfortunately, in reality, it's often a lot more challenging than that. So I think if you're speaking to a leadership team that hopefully actually care about the mission and the values of their organization, I would put it in terms of where there is an incongruence between current practice and those values, and how by solving these types of issues massively increases capacity. Because if you're seen as an organization that is trying to tackle some of the ills, people living in countries blighted by these integrity issues don't want them. So if you're setting your stall out as an organization that is seeking to address this, that's going to bring you greater, I don't like the word social license, but I can't think of a better one. It is a kind of a capacity building, long-term, setting yourself out at the front, attracting better quality funders. Being the organization that's part of positive change is being proven to bring in greater talent. It decreases the problems you might have and the resistance of the local community, increases your ability to attract the right types of partners. So it's just a sensible longer term play. And you talked about generations and how they're changing the workforce. I think most leadership teams know that we have to change, but the old ways are not the right way. So if we're talking about the sustainability of our organization and its ability to thrive in the long term, then we need to start dealing with these issues now. So if you can give me that person's half of their time, that's all I'm asking. And then when you set it in those terms, it's not really a massive ask.
Those are great suggestions. A similar question, but this time from the point of view of a trustee or a member of a board. A lot of times in third sector organizations, trustees and board members are volunteers. Yes. They may not have the experience being in that role. Their heart is in the right place. They believe in the mission and the purpose of the organization, but they've never done this before. And so they might be nervous about embarrassing themselves in the boardroom. They might not really know what to look for, what to ask. They might also not want to harm the organization. So therefore, they might remain quiet, or they might be a little bit more subdued when it comes to exercising their responsibilities. So if you are advising these, again, low to no resource, small to medium sized third sector organizations, if you're advising their trustees and board members around areas of integrity risk and what we've been discussing today, what are some ways that those trustees and board members can demonstrate their support for programming or for resourcing around these concepts? Are there questions that they can ask? Is there data that they can request? Are there specific people within the organization that they can invite to hear from? What are ways that the board can be supportive of this topic?
That's a really good question. I think that you've answered it. Multiple channels is probably best. There is obviously data on some of the areas we're talking about. Like, you know, you and I are both certified product examiners. They produce an annual report to the nation that breaks it down by sector. So there is some sort of relatively hard data around the fraud, which they define to include a broad gamut of things that would extend to corruption and money laundering and stuff like that. So I think where you can find that data, that's going to be helpful. I do think that the data from within your organization is always most powerful. So even when you're doing training, when you're doing generic case studies or ones from outside of the organization, people sort of get it, but they're not 100% tuned in. Bringing examples from within the organization, people really pay attention and they always say that's the best bit. So most organizations, even if they're relatively small, will have had some near misses or they have some mechanisms for raising concerns, maybe some level of speak up data. One of the things I've seen quite powerful recently is a kind of a culture survey. And it's not like the old classic employee culture survey. It's more around people's knowledge of risk issues, their ability to access support and leaders in a timely fashion, their trust, their perception of accountability within the organization. When you're able to present that data back and including some of the kind of quotes and comments anonymized suitably, then that tends to be quite powerful. So rather than trying to turn yourself into an expert across an area that's just constantly expanding, I would imagine it would be easier for that trustee to use data from within the organization, augmented where appropriate with externally available data.
That's really useful. I think sometimes trustees and board members might be afraid to ask, or others might not be afraid to ask, but then they might also question the validity of the data that gets to them. I had a guest on a previous episode who was talking about how information moves up through an organization and finally gets to the board. It's what he called sanctified, right? But really what happens is the corners get kind of rubbed down. It gets sanded down. And usually management and leadership try and only show the best side of the organization to the board. So board members in that case may need to dig a little bit deeper or ask directly for the raw data, maybe from the units or the field teams themselves about what they're experiencing.
Yeah. Just briefly, while we were talking, I found a file from a recent survey we conducted. And so we were asking questions about the knowledge, trust, accountability. One of them was, I am incentivized to behave ethically. And then people could sort of vote disagree on that. But they were also allowed to write comments. And some of them were super interesting. You talk about generational differences. They were, I don't think I should be incentivized. I've had thanks from the head of business integrity when they spoke up about something and that felt like an incentive to do so next time. Another person saying, I don't believe we should be incentivized to behave ethically. And so when you start to present data from within the organizations back to the board, and this is a 20 question survey. It's not complicated. We're not taking up more than 5-10 minutes of people's time. And it's coming from up and down the organization. It's anonymized so that people can do it honestly. That data, I think, can be quite arresting for the senior folks within the organization. And it's a lot harder to bat away with, oh, that won't happen to us because, which, as you said, if you're using some of the external data, sometimes people can say, oh, that's a different organization, or they've got a different culture, or they operate differently. Whereas when it comes from within your organization, the good and the bad, it is probably a bit more motivating and also tangible for the leaders.
Those examples, those comments that you gave are really interesting. From my point of view, I guess you want people to say, well, I don't think I need to be incentivized to do the right thing, but you know that that's not necessarily the case. So that's really fascinating, those answers that you just shared. Thanks for that. You also mentioned if trustees or board members or even just staff are overwhelmed with the rapid change of regulatory environments and compliance environments and all these things that are happening, CSR, ESG, all of these things that are happening, it can be very overwhelming. So if, again, the people who listen to this podcast, low to no resource, small to medium sized organizations, where can they go for continuing education? Do you have any suggestions about platforms or other podcasts or blogs, maybe online classes that they can take to stay on top of integrity risk?
I follow a bunch of people on LinkedIn, which I think helps quite a lot. So a former colleague of mine, Alison Taylor, is well worth a follow. She's very focused on sustainability and ESG. So if that's an area of interest to you, then she's a very good person to follow. I'm somewhat hesitant to recommend too many resources because I appreciate people get information in different ways. I think the podcast route that you've highlighted is a good one. There's not a whole world in this space, so you can quickly go and sample some of them and decide whether you like them. Like Christian Hunt's got Human Risk. It's quite a nice one because it's a humanized approach without sort of a focus on lots of resources. In terms of the continuing education, I've not pursued a lot of them. I know there's lots of like compliancy, money laundering, all these types of accreditations out there. And so I wouldn't want to speak about stuff I don't know about. I have taking the CFE. I think the CFE is good if you're going to be tactically involved, particularly in the investigation side of things. If you're sitting at that more senior level, it's probably going to be bit too tactical. And that may seem weird, but I think psychology and philosophy are a better point of departure. Because to go back to the beginning of this discussion, I think we need to start focusing more on behaviors and why people do what they do. And also understanding how we communicate and how that lands much more than trying to endlessly build control. So bringing back facilitation payments plus that point to an example, I was working with a Nordic organization operating across Southeast Asia, and they came in with thou shalt not pay facilitation payments. But the way it was couched is these books and records in under US legislation, we have to record these payments. But then if we're recording them, they might show up again and be in violation of the UK Bribery Act. And so you were speaking about all this legally stuff, which is a very common way people broach these topics with an Indonesian team, and they were baffled. And so the organization came back months later after a tip-off and found a major supplier fraud. And there were lots of suppliers were submitting duplicate invoices or grossing them up. But the fraud was not to the benefit of any individual. The kickbacks were used to build up a slush fund within the organization, locked in a black box that were then used to continue the facilitation payments using cash off books. So what the Indonesian team had heard was the Americans tell us to record these payments. The Brits tell us that that's illegal if we're paying them. Therefore, we probably shouldn't be recording them, right? And so they'd interpreted it as that. And when people started getting fired, they were horrified because none of them were benefiting personally. They had built this timely, costly, irritating fraud scheme they had to manage to keep the payments going for the public officials who'd otherwise grind their business to a halt. And they thought they were doing the organization a favor, and then they got fired. And that's a sort of a fairly extreme but somewhat disastrous example of why you can go and study all about facilitation payments and what a proper accounting framework should look like. But if you don't understand the cultures and the psychologies of the people you're interacting with, it's all for naught. So maybe I'm bit biased, but I would think that behavioral science would be a better point of departure. There's enough people with various technical qualifications. What we need is more people with human-centered approaches.
Wow. What an impactful story about that, those folks in Indonesia. What I have found when I was working for the U.S. government and I was doing ethics training and compliance training and things like that for USAID, and I would travel all over the world, you really had to back it up and start from the very beginning. And what I used to tell the local staff when I would come, you know, I'd fly in from Washington, D.C. I was a lawyer, all this stuff. But I would sit down with them and I would just say, I am not here to get you in trouble. I'm here to make your life easier. If you are being asked to make these payments in order to just simply get your job done, tell me. I'm not going to discipline you. What I want us to figure out is how we can change how we do business so you're not in that position. And if you approach it just simply from that point of view, people can kind of exhale, they can relax a little bit, and then you start tackling the challenge together. And this goes back to what you were saying. You're not a cop. You're not an enforcer. You're more of a coach or a teacher. You're there to support them. And because this is just simply the way that business is done in whatever part of the world it is, we need to adjust how we do business and we need to figure out how we can make sure nobody is going to get fired. I mean, that's really sad. That's such a sad story.
Yeah. And obviously, as a result, nobody wanted to deal with these very pressing issues because they were terrified of getting fired. So it was getting worse. It was very self-defeating. But what you said with the message that you were giving on those training was spot on in that aside from it being trust building, you're giving a very clear call to action. And one of the things I've really had to learn in my own business was marketing side of things. Like, how do you communicate to people what it is that they are to do? So you're writing an email. So what is it you want them to do? Well, you want them to take this survey. So sometimes I think in our integrity world, we get so busy fixating on the workings and explaining the backstory rather than just giving a really clear call to action. In that case, if there's pressure, call me. One of the feelings that I have is that when you talk about resourcing this, when you have limited resources, if you can bring someone in who's got either marketing, comms, public relations, one of those backgrounds, they're fantastic because they will help you really clarify what it is you're seeking to achieve. And also think laterally about the resources you might use. So we're building a SaaS, but in the intervening period, I looked at all of the surveying tools out there, and the ones that are available that are targeted or purposed towards risk are very dry. So the one I use is one called Scora, because it's built for lead generation and marketing, which means it's fun to use. It looks nice. It's got clever functionality. It gives you really useful data, like where people drop out on questions, how long they take to answer questions. So if you've got people taking like 20, 30 seconds to answer a yes, no question, like our leaders set a positive example or something basic like that, then that's interesting data. And so when you're looking for your risk framework, don't just be looking for people with risk in their background, because we all as humans manage it in various forms. And one of the big areas where a lot of risk falls over is in the communication piece. So if you've got people who understand communication, understand basic stuff like user experience and how to create engaging content, they're really, really invaluable as well.
I like that. That's a great suggestion, making sure you have folks who have different skill sets. It's not just quantitative or qualitative risk analysis, but having that comms and that marketing background, it makes a lot of sense. And I agree, risk can be dry. But speaking about writing, can you just tell us a little bit about your book? You haven't really mentioned it so much. And if we're talking about continuing education, tell us a little bit more about your book and what drove you to write it.
Sure. I was approached by the publisher and they approached a bunch of other people, including Christine Hunt, who I know you've spoken to as well. And they gave me kind of a blank slate. They were like, we need a book on business integrity, risk, that type of stuff. What can you write? And I called it Bootstrapping Ethics because this organization that I now run, I'm bootstrapping, I'm building it. It's not got big funders or anything like that. And one of the things that I really felt in those first few years, and I still feel, is you don't know what you don't know. And particularly around the marketing, the finance side of things, there's people who've been working in this risk area for a while. We have the curse of knowledge where we assume that something is self-evident when it perhaps it isn't. So when I was trying to write the book, I was trying to write it to that organization that doesn't have much resources, that wants to do the right thing and align risk with their values. And then I was trying to write, well, how would you do that? So the first type of it is more to do with the values bit and the strategy around it and creating a kind of a culture where people feel they can speak up. And then it progresses into bits that you can dip into, depending on whether they're relevant to you, about the more practical implementation of certain areas. So whether it's anti-corruption or conflicts of interest or whatever it is. I was trying to write to that organization that is essentially me, what I feel about marketing, they might feel about risk, because I've wasted so much time, energy, resources in the first few years by just being so susceptible to all the advice out there. Some people are, oh, marketing is all about this advertising, or it's all about this platform, or it's push emails, or it's this campaign, or it's that. And of course, the truth is, it's about you finding that blend of what works with your audience and your level of comfort. And it has to be natural, but that takes a while. And that's exactly the same metaphor for risk. We all have different risk appetite. We all do different things in our different organizations. So risk should be matched to something that's actually relevant and comfortable for you. And I think that was what I was trying to do. It was published, I think, a year ago now. And there are bits I read through now that I would change. And I think that's good as well. I'm quite happy that I'm in a constant state of flux with this stuff, because we're all learning and none of us have solved it. If we solved it, we wouldn't be having these conversations. I wouldn't say the book is anything definitive. It's just to start a conversation, and I would welcome people's input, because it's fun working with those people who are coming to it new, because there's so much less stuff to unwork that you might have in a larger organization where you've got so much more structure and politics and all that kind of stuff. So it is really fun. And the good news I would say for people who are a bit intimidated by this topic is it's really not as daunting and as much overwhelm as you think it is. If you were to pick up the news or look at the headlines, it looks awful. But for most organizations, it's actually pretty manageable.
I like what you were saying there, Rupert, about how you're trying to come at this from what am I learning? What have I learned? And how can we keep it simple point of view? It sounds like the reason you wrote the book is the reason I have the podcast. I just love talking to folks like you and everyone else I have on the show about risk and from a different point of view each time. And I certainly learn a lot. And so that's great. So what was the name of the book again?
Bootstrapping Ethics.
Bootstrapping Ethics. Excellent. So before we close out, is there anything that we didn't cover today? Anything last parting words of wisdom for third sector organizations who are trying to tackle integrity risk?
I guess just at a very high level, we talked about where your intentions risk reality. I guess if you're talking about those people at the management level or the trustee level, because you can do something, should you, is a good question to ask. And I know this is a massive generalization. If you're working in the third sector with the intention is doing good, there can sometimes be a bias towards that positivity, and maybe a little bit of more cynicism might be helpful with some of your external partners. So just that trust but verify, I guess, would be the other thing. We haven't talked so much about some of the risks posed by people doing things on your behalf or those people you partner with or provide services, etc., to you. So that would be the only other things I think didn't cover.
Okay, great. Well, maybe we'll have another episode. We can talk a lot more about trust but verify. So, Rupert, if people want to ask you questions or follow up with you or learn more about the work that you do, where can they find you out there in the worldwide webosphere?
LinkedIn would be where I probably have maintained most of presence. Again, that goes back to the marketing thing. I tried loads of the other platforms, and that was the one that was kind of easiest for me. That I did set up like a link tree because it's just easier than people for people to navigate. So that has links to the book. It has links to if you want to book a call, it has links to my LinkedIn feed. So that's sort of a one-stop shop where people can find whatever is most convenient to them. And obviously there's the website Ethics Insight. But yeah, that would be the best way.
Great. Okay. I'll make sure that we share that then in the show notes. So thank you so much for your time today. This has been such a great conversation, and I really do want to have you back on the show. I think that your experience and your point of view is just really interesting, and I also think it's really, really useful for third sector organizations. So thanks for chatting with me today.
Well, thank you so much for having me on. I think what you're doing is fantastic. And by the way, I think your content is very engaging. I love the fact that you don't pull any punches, because there's a lot of people out there who are putting out content, and they're obviously, I can see that they're trying to write it with a client in mind, and I understand why, but I think it takes real courage to do what you're doing, to look at some of the sort of sacred cows in our line of work, not least the risk matrix, and go, that sucks. I think that takes courage, and we need more people like that, because for the reason I mentioned before, if all of the stuff we've been using work, we wouldn't be having this conversation. So we need more people like you who are challenging that status quo.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I never really felt like I was brave for calling out why risk matrices don't work, but you know what? I'll take it. Thank you so much, Rupert.
So that's our show for today. Please remember to like, subscribe, and follow us for all your third sector risk information. Thanks for listening to Tolerable Risk.